shall we play a game?
What is with meat space?
You didn't say the magic word.
The files are in the computer?
We're only using a simple polyphonetically grouped 20 square digit key transpose from booster phonic form with multiple nulls.
After very careful consideration, sir, I've come to the conclusion that your new defense system sucks.
So the combination is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So it's a code breaker. No, it's the code breaker.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Cyber Tap. It is wonderful to have you here with us, Mike.
It is glorious.
This is a glorious day. Mike, how the heck are you, sir?
I'm happier now because I got little assistance and now I'm a pinball wizard, man.
Yes. Mike, you picked up a couple pinball machines.
I did.
Lifelong dream of yours. Bucket listed it.
It was. And it came very close to home, too, where they originated.
Yeah, so... You got him from producer Jim.
I did.
Like, what a weird little world we've crafted for ourselves over here at the Cyber Tap. So you picked up two fantastic pinball machines.
I outbid you for it.
Well, it didn't take much. So here's the story. Jim became the owner of some pinball machines that were in his family for a long time. These are, what, 30 years old?
1993 machines, I believe.
What year is it now?
93.
So I have to do this. I have to do this because I'm getting sold. 93 to 2003 is 10, 13. Yeah, almost 30 years old. I have to count it on my fingers for those of you at home listening in. They're about 30 years old. Been in Jim's family a long time. And you didn't have a place for him, huh, Jim?
Nope.
No, he's shaking his head. No. So he said, anybody interested
in
pinball?
Come over to my place.
So this was me. I was like, oh, I want a pinball machine. I will find a place for it. And then I looked up the value of said pinball machines, and I was like, I'm out. I'm out. I am well known as being cheap.
You are. Frugal.
And so when I saw what the pinball, the value, street value, the street value of a pinball machine, these two particular ones, which we can get into, when I saw the street value of them, I said, no, I couldn't even make an offer that would be respectable.
If what you wrote in the chat was accurate, you only really wanted one of them.
Yeah.
Correct. Presented the,
yeah.
the concept.
So these pinball machines, one is Indiana Jones Adventure Pinball.
Yep.
And Jurassic Park, which for movie nerds like us, this is like that's dream pinball machines.
Yep.
Dream pinball machines.
I mean, the only way it could have been better was been Ghostbusters. That was the only one.
Is there a Ghostbuster nice
yeah,
Ghostbuster pinball?
Absolutely. My wife is big into that, so I was kind of a I could have had something that she at least could admire. She won't play it.
But I mean, all time classic franchises.
Oh yeah.
So they fit your world well, and yeah. So you made the deal, which I was happy
I
for you.
And I mean, this stems from, there was an opportunity that my mother had years and years ago where she found an old pinball machine. When she was at some, I don't know, it was a vintage store or some trade-in show, or I don't know where she found it at. She, like, for some reason, she said, it just clicked in my mind. Something I thought would be great. She's like, but I was, you know, wanted to go home, think when we go, I'll go back the next day and I'll buy it. It was gone. It was sold when she went back the next
day. So this has been truly a kind of a lifelong, like you've always wanted. You mentioned this probably even before Jim worked here. It's come up.
We went up to the Galloping Ghost arcade.
Yeah.
They had like 15
you were disappointed.
Or so.
Yeah, you were disappointed because there was 500 cabinets and not as many pinballs.
Yeah,
but
they still had enough.
Now you're learning why.
They're super hard to move. They're hard to maintain.
Yeah. So we had... In the quest for Mike to fulfill this lifelong desire for pinball machines, quite the adventure. So we all road tripped.
Yeah.
We should mention that technician Eric bailed on us.
Yes, he did. He agreed to it and then bailed the day before.
He had some sickness. Were you sick or your kid or what? Kid. Okay, kid's sick. Yeah, kids ruin everything.
Yep.
My kids won't listen to this, so we're fine. Love them. Love you guys. But yeah, so he bailed us. So the three of us had quite an adventure. Like, I also didn't realize that where we were going to pick them up at Jim's family estate in Illinois, I didn't know it was so far away. I guess I didn't pay attention. I thought it was like maybe an hour 10 to the border.
You weren't following the chat message.
Not at all. I just totally agreed to go or whatever. So we, like, I
arranged a contract for labor with
food.
Free food.
You know, I'll do anything for an extra free meal. So we take a trip to where Eastern Illinois University is, which was interesting. I didn't know much about that. That's Jim's alma mater for undergrad.
The added benefit of this whole trip was we got the nice little producer Jim celebrity tour.
Yeah, and who knew?
It was great.
Who knew how great that little place was? I thought Directional State University, and in my Purdue snobbiness, I'm like, no, whatever, Jim. There's going to be nothing interesting here. And here we go. We go past the original Jimmy John's restaurant.
Number one.
And we go past Jimmy John's parents' house, where now the famous Jimmy John's lands the helicopter to visit. We ate lunch at Burger King.
That's not.
Now, wait a minute, folks. Yes. There's something important about this Burger King.
It is the only Burger King that is not that Burger King.
So, Jim, you might have to keep us honest on this one, but Jim was telling us that there's a place that was in Mattoon or something. That's what I said.
Booby traps.
BFE. No, so Mattoon. It's Burger King, but they had the name before Burger King had Burger King's name. And so when Burger King came around, there was actually a lawsuit, correct? I'm looking at it. I want to get this right. They got to retain the usage of the name. And not only that, is Burger King, the proper Burger King, can't put a Burger King anywhere close to this
20-mile radius.
It's a 20-mile radius? Is that what?
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. If it's 120, it's all a great story. But they can't put a real burger, what we would all recognize as Burger King, near this place. So we ate at the OG Burger King. Like,
we did.
And it was just a greasy spoon, Indiana Smash burgers. The fries were good. Did it make you sick, Jim? The fries get you a little bit? Okay, good. I was a little concerned with it.
Well, you went two burgers. Did you go fries?
He did fries too. Yeah. Oh, I had some mozz sticks because fried cheese, you know, I'll eat my weight in fried cheese anytime I get a chance. So it was good. That was fun. So we saw the original Jimmy John. We found out that Eastern Illinois, like some serious quarterbacks like Purdue's history, Romo yeah. and Garoppolo. And Painter. Who did?
Matt Painter.
Oh, Matt Painter's an Eastern Illinois guy too. Oh, look at there.
Got flipped off by Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. Abe Lincoln flipped us off. We saw a shark in the grass. Like there was a, it was,
yeah,
a,
it was.
It was an interesting little trip. We got a glimpse into Jim's childhood, which was super fun for me. Like it was just a cool experience all the way around.
Was it as disturbing for you as it was for me?
I don't know. No, I really enjoyed it actually. I had a lot of fun.
And we talked about this afterwards that, you know, I don't know how we're gonna go into this on the air, but you know, it was your dad's property and he was a very unique individual and a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, just a neat guy. And but anyway, we acquired those pinball machines for you. Helping, you know, move them was quite the adventure. So what we needed is guys with no necks, not guys with tech degrees. So you take some nerds, old nerds with bad backs and Jim. So Mike and I, old nerds with bad backs, and Jim, we go to get these things and you know, we asked, he's like, they're heavy guys. They're heavy. Like, you know, I'm a grown man, you know, whatever. Oh, no, these things are freaking unruly heavy.
Trying to figure out how many different staging points we can with the sawhorses to put it down.
And you looked up the Indiana Jones machine, weighed in the documentation about 300-some pounds.
322 pounds with a little asterisk. So.
Good night. Yeah, so there was a lot of smashed fingers and some curse
all
words.
All we could do is we took the legs off.
Yeah, right.
So the rest of the cabinet we took all one go.
Yeah, the legs of that 322 pounds, the legs weighed exactly 6.4 pounds. Like, didn't really help at all. But yeah, we moved them from Illinois. Then, of course, getting them out of Jim's property into a trailer. And then driving them back and then getting them into your basement, into your movie room, which was like, it's awesome. They look great there. It's like they were meant for there. Jim could see that. Like, they were perfect in Jim's basement, but then now they're really, really great in your theater room. They just fit so nicely.
And the stairs on both ends, not fun.
Yeah, the stairs were
equally challenged.
I'm like Kung Fu Panda. Stairs are my old nemesis anyway. Like, when I see a big flight of stairs, I'm like, I hate you. I know I'm going to be wheezing at the top of this. Now carry, you know,
G.I. Joe Kung Fu.
And there's no way for three people to carry these through for the most
awkward part.
A lot of it was just a two-man lift. So you're hoofing a lot of stairs, uneven ground, 160-ish pounds. And I'm just not that guy. I'm not that guy, Mike.
No.
But it was fun.
I appreciate the help.
Yeah, you still owe us. I think you still owe us big time.
I mean, I did pay for one of you to assist. So.
Well, you did buy them, yes. Them, so. But me, I got a Burger King burger that wasn't even a Burger King burger, and that was my payment. It was all right. I worked in the car. It was a fun day. I even took a little nap on the way back, not going to lie. Yeah, fun time. Fun time. That was quite the adventure, though. I don't know what it is about this little CyberTap podcast. We get into ourselves into some adventure sometimes.
It's not even the summer session.
It's not even the summer session, but it was a heck of a fun day. And I'm looking forward to getting back over and playing some more pinball at Mike's place. All right. Should we have a show? I mean, it's been
probably
all intro.
Should. And we probably should talk about cybersecurity of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah. What I mean, is there anything going on? Of course, there always is. But all right, we should just jump into this thing. So
let's do it.
We're still going through our series for the spring semester, which is winding down. I think it might be finals week right now. It's coming up. If it's not, we're around that time. It's the near end of the semester, and so we're getting ready to close this season. Do we have any more episodes in this season, or is this it? I'm looking at you guys.
We're shaking heads, nodding heads. This is it. This is the final.
This is it. It's the final.
All the hoopla. Episode. We didn't even know our own show was over.
We did that. We did that too. Okay. Yeah, we can't. That's twice we've used that. Now are we going to have to pay some kind of fee?
No, okay, it was good. 2 seconds.
It's education. Nobody's making money off this podcast.
Yeah, you can have 10% of everything we made. 50% of everything we made.
What's zero? What's 10% of zero? Jim, I'm looking at you. You're the engineer. Okay, I think it's zero. Yeah, it is. Okay. So last episode of the season. It's a good one. We're excited. We have a guest that's been with us before, an absolute icon of cybersecurity here at Purdue University. If you know anything about Purdue's long history in cyber, you definitely know about Dr. Spafford. So we are lucky and fortunate to have him on the show again, and it's very fitting because as we walk through those events that kind of help shape cybersecurity and information security, we get to talk about the Morris worm, which obviously Purdue and SPAF both were instrumental in that point in history. And so this is the CyberTap with SPAF. Well, SPAF, it's good to have you, sir, back on the show. It's always a pleasure. I feel like we're amongst the Purdue cyber royalty here. So, again, always a pleasure, and thanks for joining today.
I'm happy to join you, folks.
So we are in our series here. We're continuing our series as we're working back through the major events that helped to shape cybersecurity and information security. We're working back in time, insert Back to the Future reference immediately. But as we're working back through the clock here, we've come to a point where we thought it would be great, SPAF, to talk to you about something that, was, I don't know if it's near and dear or how you would describe it, but it would certainly be a part of your legacy. Is that the right thing to say? I don't know what's right to say. Maybe you could tell us about it, but we wanted to talk a little bit about the Morris worm and whatever you want to tell us about that interesting event. Now, what probably feels like yesterday to you, but is starting to become quite a historical marker in cyber and information security. So what can you tell us about the whole Morris worm story, sir?
Well, that's a really open-ended question.
It is.
Heard any recently? So let me try and put this in a little context. I've been involved in studying of and involved in information security, cybersecurity for, going on about 45 years now. That when I was an undergrad, I was interested in this. And, back then in the days of coal-fired computing, the security posture was a little bit different, but sure. I was involved with it then. And during my time as a graduate student, I worked as a system admin and security admin. And so I was involved in it there. I was involved in the community, primarily for Unix. It was part of my PhD research, although it wasn't the central part. And then I moved to Purdue and I got here in 1987. At the time, my primary research interests were in software engineering, primarily in the area of large program debugging techniques. And when in 1988, at the beginning of November, the Internet or the Morris worm hit, I was connected to the community. I had some of the tools in the background to do some of the analysis and some of the contacts to reach out and share information. So I was a part of that. And then I wrote up partly for my own use and then turned it into a couple articles, description of how the software worked, mm-hmm. that received very wide readership, that then opened some doors for me. It led to my first book. It led to some of my first funding through a federal agency. And although I continued to do some work in debugging for several years and eventually graduated 3 PhDs who worked in the area, because of the funding and the interest, I transitioned into information security, cybersecurity, where I had some other successes, which aren't the topic of this conversation, but just to give a sense of trajectory here. This year is the 25th anniversary of Professor Sam Wagstaff and I founding the COAST Laboratory, or mm-hmm. the 30th anniversary, excuse me, 30th anniversary of Professor Wagstaff and I founding the COAST Laboratory in the CS department here at Purdue, which after 5 years of growth and involvement campus-wide became Sirius, the campus-wide institute. Next year is its 25th anniversary. And that has continued to grow into a rather major mm-hmm. Organization internationally in terms of education and research. So in that sense, the internet worm incident was, I think, important in helping shape the trajectory of where I was headed. And to give a sense, it wasn't my introduction to cybersecurity. Mm-hmm, I had been mm-hmm. working in it for some time. And in fact, that sort of put me in a good position to, as I said, to respond and do some of the analysis. So that's the context.
And I appreciate that. I think that helps sets the stage nicely. So in 88, and I appreciate that context again, but in 88, there's a guy called Robert Morris, right, that writes this piece of software that becomes really what we think of as the first worm to kind of crawl the internet. Is that a fair statement? And what can you tell us about that piece of software that you remember?
Yeah, it was Robert T. Morris. There was another Robert Morris, his father. Robert T. was not a junior. Although some people have referred to him that way, mm-hmm. that is. But there had been computer worms of a sort that had been done as demonstration and had been written about in science fiction prior to the 1988 date. This was really the first one that spread widely out in the public network. Mm-hmm. Other than in a lab setting. And as we were sort of able to piece together afterwards, Mr. Morris had apparently gotten the idea for this and had some history where he was a very bright person, had been working in security, he had an internship at Bell Labs, he was a graduate student at Cornell. And he wrote the code for the worm and for whatever reason, set it loose on the internet at large on November 2nd, 1988. It was code that was in a couple parts.
Spaff, did I read right that he was, you said he was a grad student at Cornell, but he released it from labs or from systems at MIT? Did I read that correctly? Are you aware of that?
I don't remember exactly where he released it. I don't know that he had a connection at MIT, although okay. he might have. Oh, yes, that's right. MIT had some open systems that I think were associated with, Richard Stallman at the time. And anybody could log in and use the machines. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think he set them off from there rather than Cornell to try to hide his tracks.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I read.
Thank you for that reminder.
Worst university thank you prank for that ever. Reminder,
yes. I don't know. It's a pretty good prank. It's a pretty good university prank.
And there were some flaws in the code and some poorly thought out concepts. And the code may not have been finished. And basically there I'm describing almost any code that's been released in the last 30 years. And as a result, it spread, but it spread in a way that instead of being stealthy, it overwhelmed systems at many locations, and therefore became visible in overloading machines to the point where some crashed or just became unwieldy. That's how I spotted it on my machine, is that the response time just had effectively gone to zero or gone to infinity. It was so loaded. But basically the way it worked is once on a machine, it installed itself and proceeded to do some scanning to try to find other machines that it could spread to. And it did this several ways. It looked for some configuration files that might have had trust relationships of the current machine with that remote machine so that it could access it without needing a password. It tried to guess some passwords, and it generated some network addresses effectively at random to and see if there were vulnerabilities in those machines, if there were machines at those addresses. And once it found one of those machines, it would use one of several different potential flaws to insert a small program that we now call a dropper. And the dropper was a bootstrap that would install itself on the machine, call back to the machine that was doing the infecting, download the more substantial program, compile it, and run it, and then it would begin anew in searching out other victim machines. The flaw, well, one of the flaws that resulted in the problem, is that it was intended to detect if it was already running on a target and not infect. And that sort of makes sense, right? If you've already got it there, you don't need to do another version. But for whatever reason, he decided that, well, maybe he should reinfect, that maybe the one that was there was frozen or stalled or had run out of opportunities or whatever reasoning. I've never seen any public attribution as to what this was, but one out of every seven times, as a random number, it would reinstall itself. And I guess sort of to a naive point of view, you'd say, well, that isn't very much, except the way machines are connected to each other, some hosts that are highly connected would end up having scores of this program running on them. And at the time, the machines that were getting that many instances didn't do very well. So for example, on the morning of November 3rd, when I got up and I had my coffee and I was dialing in, and for those younger people in the audience, this involved using a telephone to call in and using an acoustic coupler, which is a low-speed connection.
That's very war game style of connection.
Exactly, yes. Anybody who's seen War Games understands what that is. And so I would I dialed in the morning, and it took forever to log in. And I was perplexed by this. So I logged into a different system and saw that mine was still up, but it was just not responding. So I sent a note to the system admin here at Purdue in CS, who had access, and asked if he would please reboot the machine for me. And I went off and I had breakfast and came back, and I could get into the machine, but over the next 15 minutes or so, it was getting slower and slower and slower. And I looked, and there were all of these unknown processes running in the background. And then I realized something was wrong. And one of my emails that came in that that time was from a mailing list of system admins, somebody else reporting a similar problem. And that's when I realized, oh gosh, I had better get into the office and see what's going on. So that's what happened there. That's how that how I discovered it. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got into my office, several of the people on campus, system administrators and other departments and other groups on campus, had also discovered it on some of their machines. And we started communicating with each other and communicating with those off campus who had seen this to try to figure out what was going on. That involved trying to capture copies of the code, reverse engineer the code, see what it was doing, watch it as it was running to try to figure out what it was doing. It was all a really big mystery to us at that point.
Right.
No one knew. You know, it's just a case that somebody had been on our systems, basically, and doing we didn't know what. We didn't know whether there was a person who was actively behind these, connected to them. We caught on reasonably quickly with the number of these things that were going on. There were too many to be actively controlled by even a group, so they must be somewhat automated. And I don't remember who it was here on campus. It may have been Davey Curry, who discovered a way to basically capture a copy of the code before it ran. And then we were able to disassemble it. We had tools, looked at the code, and gradually, with the assistance of others, there was a group at MIT, a group at Berkeley, some other places, that were also doing this, and we shared our intermediate results and came up with an analysis of what the code was doing. And then we, as a group here at Purdue, we came up with a mechanism that effectively protected any system from any instance of this establishing itself on the system. There had been there was a routine that created a file, and by creating a version of that file with protections that prevented it from being written, the program would fail. It would see the file was there and would fail and would no longer run. So we widely distributed that, and it became known as the Purdue Patch to people. All the while, it turned out that the machines we had locally we discovered there was a subset. At the time, there were probably 6-7 major Unix-like system vendors, and this code only ran on a select few of them. So we were able to do our analysis and communicate using the other systems that weren't affected, that couldn't support the code. It just didn't run on them. So over about a 3-day period, we became a center for information exchange about this. Our patch was widely distributed. Our analysis was merged with others and shared in the community. And we responded accordingly.
At the time when this was first going on in those first 3 days, as you were, you know, even before you became kind of the information center for the community, what were you thinking? Like, what were you feeling about it? Because
I wanted to ask that too. I mean, was there a sense of thrill for the investigation?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too. Because now, if you're in the middle of a breach or in the middle of an attack, you know, in my career, now we know what's going on. My hair is on fire, and you know, that your stomach drops
hair.
A little bit.
Hair.
I had hair at one time, Mike, yes. That your hair's on fire and your stomach drops and there's a sense of dread. But I wondered, did you have some sense of thrill being on the edge of discovery here or something? Can you remember what you were thinking and feeling at the time?
There was concern as to what this was and what it was doing to our files. There were a number of speculations that were going around about, was this a work of a foreign country? Was it a criminal activity? The fact that it kept taking systems down, loading systems, we wondered, was it intended to try to damage our systems? Mm-hmm. So at first, there was some real concern that drove a moderate amount of urgency. Mm-hmm. Now realize this is at a time when the internet as such was not being used commercially.
Right.
There was no commerce going on. There were no credit card information or bank account information online. This was a research network.
Right.
And it was primarily universities and research labs. So our concern was really sort of more for the integrity of the files and information we had online. Mm-hmm. And this was after the incident in the Cuckoo's Egg that Cliff Stahl wrote about, that I was also involved with, which is why I said, you know, I'd been involved in security for many years prior to this. So there was some concern at first. It wasn't dread. And then as we began to piece through the code, I think those of us involved were kind of excited about the idea of, well, we haven't seen anything like this before.
Right.
How does this work?
Right.
And that's when sort of the research aspect came into mind. And that lasted probably for most of the first day. Thereafter, the documentation and responding to all the press requests and emailed requests and trying to track down where it came from became more of a, okay, well, this has worked now mm-hmm. kind of
yeah,
mindset.
Sure. So
I don't know how to phrase this right. When you were trying to determine who might be the culprit or the suspect, what is the most outlandish guess or suspect that might have come up in conversations?
It's 88. It was the Russians, the Soviet Union, we should say.
Yeah, well, based on what had happened with Cliff Stahl, there was some concern. It was the East Germans, and for the younger people in the audience, the country of Germany was once two countries.
David Hasselhoff hadn't brought the wall down yet.
Yeah, that's right. And Russia was a different, it was an association of countries called the USSR. Mm. So there was concern that it might be some agents of what was then called the Evil Empire. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We didn't really view it as a criminal. It wasn't likely to be a criminal thing because, again, there was nothing of monetary value
right.
that was out there. For a few years prior to that, I had been tracking computer viruses. And there had been a couple of computer viruses in the wild. So
Skynet?
Yeah.
They did not think it was the Terminators, Mike.
I didn't think it was quite that bad.
Yeah.
We didn't think it was aliens in a UFO. This was somewhat before that capability, and I don't think Mac computers had been set up as power books at the time.
Right. Illuminati,
which is another oblique reference for those of you who. Remember Independence Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those were the conjectures.
Sure.
But we didn't really know.
Right.
Another conjecture going around is that it was a government program that had somehow gotten loose by mistake. But everybody we knew in government who might have done it disavowed any knowledge of it.
So it was
about a day and a half later we found out where it was actually from, and so that sort of answered the question.
Yeah. Now, when I think about the motivation behind Mr. Morris setting out this worm, it seemed to me that it was like the mountain climber. Like, why do you climb a mountain? Because it's there. It seemed like his goal was just to see that he could create this self-replicating crawling software, correct? But I think what you were alluding to, and maybe I have it wrong, is that by, you know, flaws in the code, it ended up causing resource and capacity issues on machines, correct? But the whole idea was just to see if it would crawl and how far it would spread, correct?
He has, to my knowledge, never made a public statement about this.
Okay.
I think he said something like that, or his, let me take this back. His lawyers said something like that at right. his trial. But it's not clear really what he was thinking.
Sure.
Whether he was thinking that he would expose a problem, whether he was doing an experiment to see what was possible, whether he was trying to show that he was much more capable than the people who were running machines. It's hard to say what it really is. Yeah. A lot of people speculated, friends of his speculated that he was doing it to demonstrate security flaws,
mm-hmm.
Which is a pretty poor way of demonstrating right. security flaws. You know, if somebody sets fire to your house to show that you don't have a good sprinkler system, that's not necessarily welcome.
Right. So you mentioned what his lawyer, like what his lawyers might have said in the trial. So I read that this was the first conviction under kind of what was then a relatively new computer fraud law or set of laws. Do you remember, because since you were so instrumental in the early discovery and the early finding and the research and the information resource kind of dissemination, do you remember the trial and do you remember the kind of criminal side of what happened and kind of any involvement or any thought about that?
Yeah. He was the first felony conviction
okay.
under Title 1030 of U.S. Code. Title 18. And Section 1030 is referred to as the CFAA or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And there had been a conviction earlier of a misdemeanor conviction under that act.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Steve Jackson Games prosecution, mm-hmm. I believe, in Texas. But I was contacted because of my analysis of the code and awareness of what had happened at Purdue. I was one of the people who gave testimony at the trial about how the code worked and what the impact was. So I'm familiar with that and mm-hmm. the determination that he was guilty, but basically received a suspended sentence, probation, and a fine.
Mm-hmm.
Effectively community service was the outcome of that.
And so I also read that Mr. Morris has then gone into academia as a professor in MIT. Do you have any relationship with him today?
No. My understanding is that he completed his degree, but then for a while went out into startup mode and helped start some internet shopping site. Made quite a bit of money, then joined the faculty at MIT, where he's done work in distributed systems, not in security.
Mm.
And I have never had any engagement with him thereafter. I suspect he's not really eager to have connection with any of those of us who were involved in the security response at the time.
I feel like you guys have to have like a class reunion, you know, like get the old gang back together and, you know, have a few beers and a few laughs about it. I don't know. Like what is your sense of it all now looking back on it? Like, obviously you talked about your feelings toward in the moment, what you were feeling when you look back on it from a historical or kind of an impactful lens, thinking about cyber and information security, kind of what do you think about it today? What do you feel about that moment in history?
I think it was inevitable. He just happened to be the first to do something like that, and thankfully he didn't have malicious intent because it could have been far worse.
According to his lawyers, right?
Looking at the code, I could think of several things that would have made it far worse.
Right.
So it could have done things like some of the wiper software that Russia has released on Ukraine this week.
Yeah.
The incident and the press that it engendered, because it was a worldwide phenomenon, and really starting a few hours after we discovered it here, I feel that I spent easily half my time giving interviews to the press, caused a lot of people to sort of sit up and go, hey, there are security issues here we got to worry about. It led to, for instance, the formation of the CERT-CC at the Software Engineering Institute in Pittsburgh by the Department of Defense. It led to a conference that was held by the Department of Defense and the National Security Agency, set up a group to look at defense of these kind of programs. And it served as sort of an impetus for a lot of people to suddenly start writing computer viruses. That said, looking back, it was really pretty innocent in a lot of ways.
Right.
And as I said, it was not apparently in any way intended to be malicious. I think Dr. Morris, because it's now Dr. Morris, he got his PhD from MIT. I believe that he, to all intents and purposes that I can discern, has been law-abiding and remarkably well-behaved and productive ever since. I don't think he intended it for it to happen the way it did. I was actually one of a group that approached the administration probably 8-9 years ago to see about getting him a pardon. We were told in no uncertain terms at the time that it would not be considered because it apparently would send a bad signal to the other people who were committing computer crimes. But I think in retrospect, if he were to do something like that today, he might end up in the same situation, right? Doing that kind of thing without permission on other people's machines is wrong. Right. It's illegal. But it would be very mild compared to what criminals in national services are doing now.
Right, right. Yeah, it seemed to me as I looked at it briefly and even through this conversation that, as you said, it was inevitable, and it's probably a very fortunate way that it was set upon the world and then the discovery came from it, because it didn't have a lasting impact. I mean, we see, like you referenced, global activity this week in cyber being weaponized for warfare, for pre-warfare, whatever, however we want to talk about it. That could certainly make an interesting conversation for another time. But yeah, I think we're fortunate that it came out the way it did, it sounds like. And I think that's interesting that you mentioned seeking pardon, to have that kind of record cleaned. And yeah, I tend to agree with you on the surface of that it, it's hard to say what that full motivation was. But at that time, I don't even know if you could really think about what the full impact was of what was going to happen. So it's very interesting to kind of consider all those things.
Yeah, I think that there are a number of lessons from this, and one of them certainly is true today, whether one is working within law or outside, and that is that it's difficult, A, to write fully correct code, and B, to understand all the consequences. And there are examples, and I think there's two really good ones in the area of malicious self-propagating software. One was the Stuxnet case. That was allegedly written by U.S.-Israel group to use against Iran to damage their nuclear centrifuges. And it was one of the later iterations of that code that was designed so that it didn't check adequately where it was running and escaped out to other systems that were then detected. Mm-hmm. It would have continued to only operate in the Iranian systems except for that flaw. And that flaw actually allowed it to be discovered and sort of, I won't say it was a wake-up call, but sort of demonstrated how to weaponize cyber.
Right.
The other kinds of example that was actually a Russian software that was used against Ukraine back in, I think it was 2016.
Is this the NotPetya?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I don't remember the date now. I think it was 2016.
Yeah, I think, 16, 17, something like that. Something
yeah, like and, that. And NotPetya was intended to only impact Ukrainian systems.
Right.
So I don't know if your listeners are aware, but Russia has been waging low-level activity, not quite warfare, but damage mm-hmm. against the Ukraine ever since the Ukraine voted for independence 20 or so years ago. And this was intended to cause damage to some of their financial systems and accounting. Mm-hmm. But because of a flaw in the software, it got out and caused worldwide damage in the right. amount of billions of dollars.
Yeah, and it hit, I remember reading about NotPetya quite a bit, and it seemed to, there were several examples of companies that were completely taken offline. Large logistics companies, I think FedEx and Maersk and places like that really suffered some
yep.
significant damage, significant losses. And when we say losses in revenue, losses in business, right? So your business is hampered. And I think, because I wrote a presentation once about, I think it was just a ransomware presentation, and I think it, and don't quote me on this one, Mike, but I think it even hit the Cadbury Chocolate Factory in Europe. and I included that because it was a wild, I saw a lot of logistics companies. Obviously, there was financial sector in Ukraine. I think there might have been some impact to critical infrastructure, and then Cadbury Chocolate Factory. So to your point, this one crawled without concern of where it was going and had very detrimental impact to anyone, anywhere that it got infected.
Yeah, and it also had another interesting effect in that a number of those firms had cyber insurance that was intended to cover losses, and they filed claims. But because the code had been identified as a product of Russia, probably their GU, their military, formerly the GRU, their military intelligence mm-hmm. Organization. The insurance companies said they weren't going to pay because it was an act of war. Well, some of the larger companies took the insurance companies, the victims' companies, took the insurance companies to court. And that was actually settled just towards, I believe, the end of last year, early part of this
year.
Is that
right?
Where U.S. courts said, no, it wasn't actively war, and companies, you have to pay up on the insurance. So that's likely to have some really interesting ripple effects through the cyber insurance arena in the time to come.
Yeah,
to mention what's going on in Ukraine right now.
Right, today, yeah. And that's, cyber insurance is an interesting world. We've seen very cheap, not very comprehensive or sometimes comprehensive policies, and now the total opposite has developed in recent terms, where you have to really validate that you're healthy, your systems are healthy, and then policies are going up and limitations on payment. That's a whole nother can of worms to get into for another day, for sure.
Just mentioned Definitely. A lot of separate events that supposedly act as a wake-up call, but yet we still keep running into these events that we find out there's flaws. There's people haven't updated, or they haven't patched, or they haven't get air gapped, or whatever they need to do to make the thing secure. Are we at a point now where enough of the industry is aware, or do you think that there's still a long way to go?
I think as long as we continue to approach security and software development the way we do, we're going to continue to have problems. The approach, because of economics and lax regulation, is to turn out products that are not fully tested, are not developed with security and privacy in mind, and are adopted by organizations on the basis of how cheap they are and what flashy new functionality they have. Meanwhile, we have a shortage of people who are trained in good security practice. So a lot of these organizations don't have staff. They depend on marketing hype for their security. And as a result, when a new flaw comes along or a new aggressor, we have the same old things occur all over again. As an example, one of the flaws exploited by the Morse code back in 1988 that was actually known from about 1973 is a problem known as buffer overflow. We are still seeing products in the market that are susceptible to buffer overflow all this time later.
History is repeating itself. Well, thanks for bringing us up at the end of the show here, Mike. That's real upper. Trying to take us out on a downer here, Mike. Gee, many Christmas. Spaff, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that I think part of this is, and this is perhaps a hopeful note, there's a really chronic need for people who understand good programming structure, good software engineers, people who understand security. It's a great career field for somebody who wants to get into it. And of course, Purdue is one of the places with a premier education program in several varieties of this. And with continuing impact of these events, we're beginning to see some change in regulation. There have been a series of executive orders in the US and in the UK and some other countries. What's happening in Ukraine now is also going to serve as a stark warning to many countries that they have to do something different. So the potential is there for change. If any of the listeners to this podcast are in a position where you didn't know that East Germany was a separate country, so that means you're a little younger and you're still looking for a career path, or you're looking to change your career path, this would be a great place for you to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Spaff, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. We appreciate your years of dedicated service to this domain and to this field of study, and of course to Purdue University. You know, Mike and I are both graduates, and so we appreciate, you know, all the faculty and all the staff and all the administration here, of course, but we bleed black and gold, and so you know, just all your years here and helping to establish the CS department and Coast and then Sirius and all of those things that you've been involved with. We just really appreciate you and really appreciate your time today.
Great. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and maybe there'll be another topic we can cover.
I'm sure there will be.
We'll invent one.
Well, thanks again, Spaff. Thanks, Mike. And thank you to all our listeners. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you want to reach out to us, you can find us at CyberTapPodcast@purdue.edu. I've only been doing this for a couple years now, and I still trip up on that email address, CyberTapPodcast@purdue.edu. Thanks again, guys. We'll see you next time.